Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, France announced that it was planning to revive the Israeli-Palestinian peace process by holding a meeting of foreign ministers in Paris at the end of the month. According to reports, Israelis and Palestinians will not be invited to the first conference, but it will include 30 countries and international organizations, including the Quartet of the UN, the EU, Russia, and the United States. The Israeli Prime Minister has said he rejects the European-backed initiative, while Palestinian officials say they support it. In an interview, Foreign Minister Jean-Marc Ayrault has said that the aim of the conference is to prepare an international summit in the second half of the year, which would include leaders from Israel and Palestine. He said there is no other solution to the conflict than establishing two states, one for Israel, one for Palestine, living side by side in peace and safety with Jerusalem as a shared capital. But some argue that past peace talks have resulted in the continuation of the occupation, the expansion of settlements, and the rise in violence. So is the window for a two-state solution already sealed, or is there still hope for a two-state solution? And what is in store for the future of Israel and Palestine? Today we are joined by two guests. Ziv Moaz is professor of political science at UC Davis and the author of several books, including Defending the Holy Land, a critical analysis of Israel's security and foreign policy. And Professor Moaz joins us from UC Davis. Hi, Professor Moaz. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, at least here in California.
Good morning. We're also joined by Ilan Pape, professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. Professor Pape is the author and editor of several books, including Israel and South Africa, The Many Faces of Apartheid. Professor Pape will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Professor Pape joins me in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Pleasure to be on your program.
It's great to have you. So Israel and Palestine is a very contested topic in the U.S., as you both know. You are both from Israel. And I wanted to ask you first about why you think historically that there has been unconditional support for Israeli policies in the United States. Over the past couple of years, we have seen a couple of cracks, for example, the relationship because of the Iran nuclear deal. But then just in the last few weeks, President Obama has proposed the largest military aid package to Israel. Israel is asking for a 10-year military package that could top $40 billion, and the United States Senate is urging President Obama to do this. So, Professor Pape, let's start off with you. How do you explain the relationship?
First of all, I think there are historical similarities between the two states. They are both settler colonial states. And I think even if people are not totally aware of American history, and most Americans are not aware of their own history, neither are Israelis aware of their own history, there's something in the way these two states came into being at the expense of native indigenous people that creates a certain affinity. In a more kind of political terms, I think that the support for Israel is like a stool which has three legs. One leg lies on the or is supported by the pro-Israeli lobby, AIPAC, which I think is a powerful agency that reorientates American policy constantly towards this unconditional support. The second leg is the Christian Zionist community, a very powerful American phenomenon that even had not that long ago a president in the White House that was part of that ideological framework. And I think they're also playing a very important part. And finally, there is this kind of industrial military complex, which has its own logic when it comes to alliances. And Israel provides all the kind of benefits for this complex that usually is also motivated by neocon kind of ideologies. So it goes well together, the production of arms, selling of arms, researching arms, and also believing that power is the only solution for maintaining American interest in the Middle East.
Professor Moaz, what would you add to that, or how do you answer this question? Why do you think there is so much unconditional support for Israeli policies in the United States?
First, I agree with Professor Pape on several aspects of his analysis. Certainly, the Israel lobby is an important player in American politics, probably one of the most influential pressure groups or interest groups in the United States. The Jewish community in general has a very strong voting record and a very high turnout record, and therefore both parties consider it a valuable electoral asset. But I think beyond that, there is a general public support for Israeli politics on which many politicians rely when they are campaigning, and that has to do with a sense of common democratic values, basically understanding that Israel is a stable democratic country in a region that is plagued by instability, violence, extremism, and so on. And so there is a certain affinity. I don't know how much it is based on some sort of historical ignorance, but I think that there is a certain democratic affinity that applies not only to the relations between Israel and the United States, but generally speaking a favoritism towards Israel in the Western democratic world in general.
Professor Moaz, you are at UC Davis, and so you work with young people on a regular basis. What are your thoughts on younger American Jews and their connection with Israel? How do you see that changing?
I think it is changing. I think the younger Jewish generation in the United States has become more critical of Israel, less attached to its own identity as Jews, and the consequent affinity with Israel. And so in general there is a decline in unconditional support for Israeli policy among younger American Jews. We see it in multiple polls. I see it in class. But on the other hand, there is a sense of growing anti-Semitism in the United States and in Europe, which brings many younger and less committed Jews to the fold of Judaism, and that, in fact, has increased European immigration to Israel orders of magnitude in the last couple of years.
That is Professor Ziv Moaz. He is a political science professor at UC Davis. We're also joined by Ilan Pape, professor of history at the University of Exeter. Now, what about differences between parties in the United States? Professor Pape, we have heard similar sentiments from Democrats and Republicans about supporting a two-state solution. Some of them talk about settlements, some don't. What do you think are the main differences between the two parties?
I think the differences are not very big. Rhetorically, there might be some differences, but policy is being examined by what is being done on the ground, not by words. And whether it was a Democratic or a Republican administration, the same license to Israel to colonize the West Bank, to besiege Gaza, has been granted. So in terms of policy, the parties have never really, or whoever was in the White House, did not matter much from the Palestinian victims' perspective. Some presidents, actually some Republican presidents like George Bush Sr., were much tougher on Israel than any Democratic president. In fact, he was probably the toughest in many ways when it comes to historical perspective. So I think Israeli policymakers feel very secure with politics from above in the United States. The issue that really Israel has to think about is that politics from below, the kind that actually we are seeing happening in this particular election campaign, I think doesn't bode well for Israel. I think for many people, this is about what policy should look like, not according to cynical interests of politicians, but according to what people feel is just and unjust. And I think very few Americans have doubt who is the criminal and who is the victim in this context.
You write about history, and we don't hear that very often, what you just said about George H.W. Bush. Can you talk more about that and what changed?
I think what changed is that the Israeli, especially the liberal Zionists in Israel, very cleverly in many ways, I think, understood that if the occupation continues, even American presidents would find it difficult, if they want to maintain their interest in the Middle East as a whole, to continue and license Israeli brutal policies towards the Palestinians. And I think that was the genius kind of ideas behind the Oslo Accord, that if you remember, killed, historically, the Oslo Accord killed an initiative by President Bush through the Madrid Conference to have a really profound discussion about the situation in Palestine. Now, the Oslo process created the idea that peace is just around the corner, and a lot of the pressure that was exerted on Israel disappeared. I think also 9/11, 2001, and this wave of Islamophobia absolved Israel from some of the criticism which is coming back now after so many years. So I think that we should not take a teleological determinist view of American administration. In the past, they were known to take some tough positions toward Israel. Mm. But it had nothing to do with party politics. It had to do with the personality of the president, and it had to do with public opinion in the United States.
Professor Moaz, what would you add to that? What strikes you about the Democrats and the Republicans, where they differ or don't differ on Israel and Palestine?
Yes, I think there is an interesting, what if you look at the campaign rhetoric of the main Republican candidate and the leading Democratic candidate, you can see some interesting differences, at least rhetorically. And I generally agree with Dr. Pape that in terms of policy, there was very little difference between Democratic and Republican administration. But the rhetoric has become different. If you compare what people like Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders are saying to their competitors, and you see that both Trump has stated that he's going to take a more impartial view of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and he will try, in his word, to strike a deal. And Bernie Sanders, and at least in the recent debate with Hillary Clinton, was quite critical of Israel's recent operation in Gaza, and suggested that a more even-handed approach is required. And so you see that kind of thing, at least in the rhetoric. What we do know about American Jewish voting patterns is that they're overwhelmingly Democratic. So regardless of various positions of candidates towards Israel, or Obama was seen as less pro-Israel than either McCain or Romney, and nevertheless got a overwhelming majority of the Jewish vote. So that doesn't really play an important role in actual politics. Once a president steps into the Oval Office, he or she will evaluate American policy towards Israel in terms of American national interest, in terms of his electoral prospects, in terms of access of various interest groups, and that has been the case in the past. And so what we've seen is that Obama, who has been regarded as less pro-Israeli than his predecessors, has nevertheless continued, and Professor Pape is obviously correct about that, has continued to support Israel. As you've mentioned, there is a significant aid package, long-term aid package on the agenda towards Israel, And so that hasn't changed, at least, and it doesn't seem to be changing in the short term. Whether the rhetoric of any of these candidates, when if they come to power, will affect their policies, this is something to be seen. But so far, we don't see a fundamental change in American policy towards Israel. Grassroots pressure of the sort of the BDS movement in the United States will have an effect on American policy is questionable, at least in the short term, because things that are happening in the Middle East right now have, despite French initiative, have lowered the centrality of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict compared to what's going on in Syria, the instability in Libya, the civil war in Yemen, and other kinds of the rise of radical Islamic militants and the recruitment in Europe and the United States. So these have pushed other issues to the top of the policy agenda of the administration, and they coincide with the fact that U.S. requires Israel in its fight against terrorism because of Israel's intelligence capabilities and so on.
That is Professor Zeev Moaz. He teaches political science at UC Davis, is the author of several books, including Defending the Holy Land, A Critical Analysis of Israel's Security and Foreign Policy. Ilan Pape is professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. He is the author and editor of several books, including Israel and South Africa, The Many Faces of Apartheid. Professor Pape will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the First Congressional Church in Berkeley. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, today we are talking about what's in store for the future of Israel and Palestine. What do you think are the best ways to bring about a just peace in Israel-Palestine? We have done so many shows on this issue since I've been hosting for almost 10 years. We have seen some changes, but have we seen many changes? I'll ask both of our guests in a minute. What do you think? What do you think about the role of the United States? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And since we're talking about United States politics, Professor Pape, I wanted to ask you, in the last debate between presidential hopefuls Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton did not criticize Israel in that debate. In fact, she has pledged multiple times that if she is elected president, she will meet with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu in her first month in office. Now, Bernie Sanders said, quote, "We are going to have to treat the Palestinian people with respect and dignity. You usually don't even hear Palestinian people in any presidential debate." So the fact that he said that really made international headlines. What does that say to you?
Well, I think it really depends from which perspective you're looking at it. From a Palestinian perspective, especially Palestinian victims on the ground, this is too little, too late. I don't think it really makes much of a difference viewed from Gaza, Hebron, or even Ramallah. However, from the context of American politics, it is significant, rhetorically at least, as we both mentioned before. And it's a sign, I think, not so much it doesn't tell us much about Bernie Sanders' own agenda. It just shows us that anyone who is not part of the party establishment probably listens more carefully to the electorate. And this is something the electorate is sending to these hopeful candidates who want to not only be presidents but also to defeat their own establishments. So the agenda of Americans who have not lost faith in politics, who are not cynical about what goes on in their own country and in the world at large, this agenda is very clearly pro-Palestinian. And I think even they would find Bernie Sanders' words not enough in terms. You don't want just to humanize the Palestinians. You don't want just an even-handed approach. You want a very clear, critical position against Israel. But I think it tells you that something has happened in politics, not just in America, in the West as a whole, I think we still don't realize the impact of the crisis of 2008, both in the United States and in Europe. The present politicians, and even those who kind of come behind them, are in the 30s and the 40s, and they still emulate the politicians before them. But behind them, there is a generation of people in their early 20s who have a very different take on politics. Usually we only found them in the NGOs and civil society, but at least in Europe, I can say, they are entering the political corridors of powers, if you want. And very curiously, in Britain and in the United States, two very old gentlemen from the left, Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, represent what they believe is good in politics and what is bad in politics. And I think Corbyn in the United Kingdom and Sanders are just the means to get us to a very different kind of politics. Now, this may not happen, but if this would happen in America, this would really signify a significant shift in the policy towards Palestine. And for these people, unlike people in think tanks and universities and so on, Palestine is still the issue. It is true, and I agree with Ziv, that for the mainstream media, academics, foreign policy makers, Palestine is not a central issue. There are more important issues. But it is not true for the group of young people who are going to inform our political scene in the next 10 or 20 years. For them, Palestine is the issue which is connected to the other issues that were mentioned. And we haven't talked yet about the French initiative, but one of the reasons the French initiative has been taken is that even the French policymakers understand that in the public mind, there is a connection between the absence of peace in Palestine and the rise of Islamic radicalism. Contrary to the narrative that Israel was trying to push forward, that Islamic radicalism is anti-Semitic, has nothing to do with Palestine, people in France and all over Europe understand that as long as the Palestine issue is not resolved, there is a danger for destabilization in the Middle East that affects life in Europe as a whole.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk about what's happening in France and why they are planning to hold that summit right after a break. But let's just take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I want to preface by saying I am an old Jewish woman, and as I have seen over the years, Israel becoming more and more oppressive and right-wing, and I am constantly upset that we are giving them money. I think that they need to stand on their own two feet. We have problems in this country that need that money, not giving money to Israel, especially the way they are oppressing the Palestinians. To me, I'm just sick about it. I mean, you know, I know people talk, well, you know, the Palestinians are, you know, sending rockets, et cetera, into Israel. Well, when you have a people who are so frustrated and so downtrodden and see no future, of course they're going to do things against their oppressors. And, you know, Israelis should know that. They've been, you know, Jewish people have been through oppression, and they seem not to care about oppressing other people. And I remember seeing a program on public TV many years ago where it was a contrast between, I think it may have been Hebron, and how the people live there, and then the kibbutz, and they're, you know, they have all their sprinklers, you know, on, and all the green grass and everything else, and the people in Hebron are suffering from no water and no paved streets, and it's terrible. And Israel, you know, refuses to stop building settlements, and we just keep supporting them. And anyways, I'm just furious. And the Israeli idea that, well, you know, they have a right to be there because the Bible says it. The Bible is a bunch of fairy stories.
Well, thank you for calling in, Nancy. You brought up a number of points there. First off, Professor Moaz, what are your thoughts about the United States Senate pressuring President Obama to increase the 10-year military aid package to $40 billion?
Well, I think that It's a Republican Congress, and the Republicans have made it an issue to increase support, increase military spending, and increase support for anyone that presumably serves American interests. The Congress, as you may know, was generally opposed to the Iran agreement, and the only fact that they didn't have a filibuster majority in the Senate prevented that deal from being derailed. So the general attitude of Congress is totally uncritical towards Israel. If Congress remains in the hands of Republican after the November elections, it will continue to press and probably will pass. I don't know if it would be possible to pass the package during this administration, but if the Congress remains Republican, it will almost certainly accept Israel's request to raise the military aid package in the next administration. So I don't see any short-term change. Even if you have a Democratic Congress, I don't think that there's going to be a major reduction in the military and economic aid to Israel in the near future. So I empathize with the lady from Berkeley's desire to reduce or stop aid to Israel, but I don't think it's likely to happen anytime soon.
Zeev Moaz is professor of political science at UC Davis. Ilan Pape is professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will address Nancy's question about settlements. We will also talk about the meeting in France that's taking place later this month with foreign ministers. The goal is to revive the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you may email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Reveal from the Center for Independent Reporting coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig about the history of superdelegates and electoral democracy in the United States. 712 superdelegates can support any candidate they choose, and they can switch their support at any time. So who are these superdelegates? How democratic is this process? And is there a better way to choose a presidential candidate? And then on Wednesday, we will talk about the recent shootings in San Francisco and the hunger strike that is well into its second week in front of the police department in the Mission District of San Francisco. Thursday, we'll be joined by Peggy Orenstein to talk about her new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today on Your Call, we are having a conversation about the prospects for a just peace in Israel and Palestine. France is planning to hold a summit to restart the peace process, but critics say the expansion of settlements, Israel's shift to the right, U.S. support for Israel has really diminished the prospect of an independent, viable Palestinian state. So what do you think? What are your thoughts on this issue? What changes have you seen over the years? And what changes would you like to see? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Zeev Moaz, professor of political science at UC Davis, author of many books, including Defending the Holy Land, A Critical Analysis of Israel's Security and Foreign Foreign Policy. Ilan Pape is Professor of History and Director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter, also author of many books, including Israel and South Africa, The Many Faces of Apartheid. Professor Pape is speaking tonight at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley, 2345 Channing Way. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Professor Pape, Nancy wanted to talk about the settlements. And according to Israel's Peace Now, the number of West Bank settlements Israel plans to build more than tripled in the first quarter of this year compared to the same quarter last year. More than 450,000 people live in settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem. So how realistic is a two-state solution given the realities on the ground?
Yes, I think Nancy made a very several very good points, and she was very articulate, and one should commend her for that. The settlement reality on the ground is one of many indicators that the two-state solution is long dead and gone, and we have to go back to the drawing desk and look for new ideas, because this one is not working. It has been attempted for more than nearly 50 years with all the international support behind it, and it seemed to be a waste of time. And in those 50 years, more settlements were built, more Palestinians were killed, more Palestinian houses were demolished. In short, the destruction of Palestinian life continued under the umbrella of the discourse or conversation about the two-state solution. So I think that indeed, if you point to the settlements, you get a very indicative proof that why the two-state solution is not working. But that's not the only reason that the two-state solution is not working. The main reason is not the settlements. The main reason is that the two-state solution is an Israeli idea of how to have the West Bank as a territory without having the people within the demographic balance of power. As your listeners know, Israel wants to be both democratic and Jewish. That means it is constantly worried about the issue of demography. It always wants the Jews to be democratically a majority, not just demographically, but also democratically. And the moment Israel occupied the West Bank, the demographic balance became a problem, because between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, you almost have now an equal numbers of Palestinians and Jews. So you can't have this idea, which anyway, to me, ideologically and morally, is not the right idea. But even from a Zionist perspective, it is not working when you have the West Bank, and the West Bank population is part of your control. So they devised the kind of idea that we can find it in apartheid South Africa, where you allow the Palestinians to have autonomy. You put them in enclave, if you want, you put them in reservations, and you tell them you can run your own affairs. You can even call it a state, as long as I don't have to include you in my demographic balance. Namely, I don't have to give you the right to vote and to decide your own future. And that is what the two-state was in essence from the very beginning. It was never meant to be a solution that grants equal sovereign rights to both people. And while the world was talking for 50 years about a two-state solution, the Israelis, and it didn't matter whether they were from the left or from the right, implemented in a unilateral way this idea that you divide, actually, especially the West Bank, into a Jewish West Bank and a Palestinian West Bank. And what we have now is Area C, which is 50% of the West Bank. Area C is, according to the Oslo Accord, is an area where Israel has the security responsibility. And this area is now incrementally being annexed to Israel. It's 50% of the West Bank. The Palestinians are left with half of the West Bank, and only half of that half they have full authority. It's called Area A. So I don't want to bore your listeners with details, but what I'm trying to say is that if you start to talk about a two-state solution in 2016, at best you're talking about a Bantustan, a small Palestinian reservation in the West Bank, maybe connected to a small Palestinian reservation in the Gaza Strip, which will not solve any of the outstanding problem between Israelis and Palestinians, and is an assured formula for the continuation of the conflict.
But this is what we hear from governments around the globe. For example, the French foreign minister, in talking about this upcoming summit, says, quote, the two sides are further apart than ever. There is no other solution to the conflict than establishing two states, one Israeli and the other Palestinian, living side by side. We cannot do nothing. We have to act before it's too late.
Yes, but that's empty rhetoric of French politicians. I wouldn't take it too seriously.
And U.S. politicians and some Israeli politicians.
Absolutely. Politicians are thinking about the next elections. They don't think about genuine solutions for violence and conflict. The world would have looked very differently if politicians really cared about us mortal human beings. They don't care about that. There is a problem for France. It cannot do what it does in its own idea of a war against terror without at least balancing it with some sort of pro-Palestinian or at least pro-peace discourse. But these words have no connection to the reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is in 2016 that there is one state called the State of Israel that controls everything between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. It is in many ways an apartheid state. It's not a democracy anymore. It is in many ways a state that exercises ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians in the West Bank and genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. It's a rogue state that unfortunately has the image of being a democratic state and therefore enjoys exceptionalism that most rogue states in the world would not have enjoyed. But it's time to call a spade a spade and to explain to people the criminality behind that and work together towards a very different reality for the sake not only of Palestinians, but for the sake of Jews who live there as well.
So Professor Pape says the two-state solution is dead for the very reasons he just described. What are your thoughts?
I disagree. I think that it's a matter of political decisions. I think that it's just a matter of bringing the parties together. They were very close to a final status agreement several times in the past. They basically lacked the political courage to reach there. But the general contour of a two-state solution is fundamentally accepted by both leaderships or by previous Israeli leaderships and by the current Palestinian PLO leadership. I think that, yes, it's going to be very difficult to implement a two-state solution when you have 400,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank. There has to be a significant resolve because it will involve removing and essentially breaking down and dismantling multiple settlements and moving many settlers from the West Bank back to Israel proper. But the historical fact is that the two-state solution is not an Israeli invention. It's actually an international invention, and I'm surprised at Professor Pape that calls it an Israeli invention. It's the two-state solution started with the Peel Commission of 1936, continued with the UN Partition Resolution of 1947, and had different incarnations over the years. But the concept that Israelis and Palestinians can live together in one state is a reality that is essentially a pipe dream in a region that is plagued by ethnic partitions, by authoritarianism, by every single country in the Middle East is either governed by an oppressive government currently or is in total chaos and huge levels of violence. So bringing in such different communities with one significantly more developed than the other and trying to mix them into a single community with a history of hatred and animosity and suspicion is not going to work. And that's why a lot of people throughout the world believe that the two-state solution is the only solution. And I agree, it is very difficult to implement, and it's becoming increasingly difficult. every day that passes without a negotiated solution. But ultimately, the only way to bring peace to that particular part of the Middle East is to get the two parties together, agree on a negotiated settlement, and separate them.
Can I just come on just shortly on two issues? Historically, because Zionism is a colonialist project, it doesn't stand to reason that the colonized people would agree to partition their homeland. It didn't stand to reason that people in Algeria would agree to partition Algeria between them and the white colonialist settlers. And that's what happened with the idea of partition. It was offered by the Zionist movement to the British and later on to the United Nations as the best solution. Palestinians boycotted both the Peel Commission and the United Nations effort exactly because of that, because the only people, it also stands to reason, the only people who would offer to divide the homeland into two are colonizers and settlers. Native people would never say, oh, you know what, it's a great idea, let's divide the land with settlers. So I think it is important to understand partition is part of the Zionist project. It can never be part of the Palestinian idea. There are Palestinians who supported it for historical reasons, for functional reasons, because they are disempowered. I think even the PLO, when it accepts partition, it hopes that it's just a temporary means for a full liberation. We have to understand that. So partition is a Zionist idea, and it makes sense as a Zionist idea. It doesn't make sense at all as a Palestinian idea. Secondly, I really don't think and I'm surprised, because I really like many things that Ziv Moav is writing about. I'm surprised that he chose to depict the Palestinian society and the Jewish society as two societies with a different level of development. This is utterly wrong. The two societies are divided inside themselves to people who are rich, who are poor, who are cultured, who are developed. Race or nationality or religion has nothing to do with being developed. It depends on means, on opportunities, and there are many Israelis who are underdeveloped, and there are many Palestinians who are very developed, and I think they are able to live together because they have much more in common than in not. And let me just final saying here, people mistake the one-state solution as a kind of utopian prophetic idea of love. This is not love. A one-state solution is not about loving each other. It's finding a political framework that would allow people to have equal rights. The two-state solution will continue the oppression of the Palestinians forever. And that's why we have to think about a political outfit, whether it's federation, a binational state, a secular democratic state. Any of these outfits has much better chance of offering equality and rectification of past evils, such as the expulsions of the refugees and allowing them to come back, than the two-state solution, which is meant to secure Israeli hegemony in historical Palestine.
Professor Moaz?
Yes, well, you know, I empathize with this idealistic belief that people in the Middle East can live together in peace and harmony, and that any other solution is essentially an oppressive solution. But let's look at the Middle East in general. Which of the countries, the state in the Middle East, has some sort of natural formation process? They're all imposed. The Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan is a colonial project. The way Iraq was established and the way it was governed for years is a colonial project, and it seems to be breaking up as we speak. Syria is in a process of implosion. Libya, which was governed by the iron fist of Gaddafi, became a state of anarchy, a tribal state and a failed state. So if we look at the Middle East and we ask ourselves, what do we want to establish? A just solution? A just solution, the pursuit of a just solution for a Palestinian who have denied Israel's right to exist for decades has only doomed them into a destiny of destitute, of poverty, of lack of independence, and lack of hope. So the question is not what we would like to see in an ideal world, but what is practical. And what is practical? And that's why a lot of people throughout the world believe that you can't really create a reality where Israelis and Palestinians will live in peace in a region where no one lives in peace, no ethnic group lives in peace with another ethnic group. So the only way is separation. The way it has to be separated is finally providing a Palestinian independence within a framework of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, and maintaining a stable relation, maybe a federation, maybe some sort of confederation could be established. But ultimately, what the Palestinians need is independence. And in a state, in a one-state solution, it's clear that they will gain independence. And there is a fundamental difference of economic, educational, and political development between Israel and the Palestinians. If you look at the UN Human Development Index, see where Israel is located on this index, and see where the Palestinian Authority is located on the index. So you'll see that in terms of major economic indicators, health-related indicators, educational indicators, Israel is ranked as one of the top OECD countries, one of the highest countries in terms of human development, and the Palestinians are ranked way down low. So there is a difference. And if you were going to create one society from two such diverse society, you're going to actually exacerbate inequalities. So even in ideal terms, in terms of where you want to create a harmony of two societies, you're going to actually polarize these societies, because that's not going to provide enough opportunities to the Palestinians to develop in a society where their starting point is so low compared to the Israeli starting point. The only way where you can actually grant them an opportunity to develop is when they have their own state, when they can establish their own political and social and economic institutions.
And that is Ziv Moaz, professor of political science at UC Davis. Ilan Pape is professor of history at the University of Exeter. Professor Pape, would you like to respond?
I was thinking when Ziv was talking about the African Americans. Actually, what he says, if the African Americans are in a very low socioeconomic conditions compared to the whites in this country, there's never a chance for them to be integrated in the society. Because of the oppression of the whites, they find themselves in lower socioeconomic parameters or indicators. The best thing for them is to stay in the ghettos and not to be integrated in the rest of the society, because they have a different kind of reality, a reality that was the outcome of oppression. In other words, to come and talk to the Palestinians who were victims of colonization and occupation that created the economic problems in the West Bank. It's not the nature of the Palestinians. It's not their religion. It's not their culture that brought them to the condition in which they are. It is the Zionist colonization of Palestine that destroyed the infrastructure of the Palestinians. And to say that this is the only way to solve the problem is to perpetuate this imbalance, to perpetuate this oppression, is really unacceptable in many ways. We should, of course, talk about, as we do in South Africa, of restitution. We have to change the imbalance that is a result of oppression, apartheid, and discrimination. We should not say, well, unfortunately, because of discrimination and apartheid, these people are not as well off as we are, and there's no point in integrating us together. And I think it is very important to get rid of this discourse that says to the Middle East as a whole, well, unfortunately, you people are violent and cannot live together, and therefore we have different solutions for you than we will ever, ever suggest to ourselves. This is unacceptable, and this is the root of the uneasiness in the relationship between the United States and the rest of the world.
And also, colonialism played such a huge role in shaping and crushing so many social movements in the 20th century. Absolutely. In that part of the world. We don't have much time left. This gathering in France is going to happen, as I said, later this month to bring back a possibility of talking about a two-state solution. The Israeli prime minister rejects this conference. It's backed by the EU. The Palestinians say they support it. Professor Pape, why now? What do you think about this?
Well, as I said, I think for French politicians and European politicians, they are at the juncture where they are abusing their own civil the rights of their own civilians and so on, as you did here in the United States after 9/11, using the so-called war on terrorism and the natural and justified fear of more terror attacks on French and European soil. But they are still, they realize that they have to balance it with something. It's nothing to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I think they realize something that John Kerry said, if I'm not mistaken, 9 months ago. He said, as long as the Arab-Israeli conflict continues, young people would like to join Daesh. And I think he's right. And I think they understand this connection. So somehow, without really serious and profound preparation, they want the rhetoric of the peace process to continue. I don't think even the French prime minister thinks, and he's an honest man, that this will change anything on the ground. This is the fate of Palestinians, that the rhetoric about the future serves domestic purposes, but nobody is willing to face the main obstacle for peace and reconciliation in Palestine and Israel. And this is the Israeli ideology, the very idea of a Jewish state. All these ideas have to be reopened, and we have to build there, hopefully, a better political outfit for everyone concerned.
Ilan Pape is professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. He is speaking tonight at 7:30 at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley, 2345 Channing Way. Ziv Moaz is professor of political science at UC Davis. Professor Pape and Professor Moaz, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig about electoral democracy. This summer, 4,763 delegates will attend the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. 712 superdelegates can support any candidate they choose, and they can switch their support at any time. So who are they? How democratic is this process? And is there a better way to choose a candidate? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.